Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is now 2 p.m. And if I could first ask the sound tech if we could return to, thank you very much, the session timer as distinct from the time. Just before we resume, I think it's worth remarking that we are under considerable time pressure. We must get through the anticipated contributions to these two sessions and still complete the end of the agenda. I do think, ladies and gentlemen, therefore, we probably need to foreshadow that we may be looking at a finish at after 5 p.m. this evening. But even so, if I could ask all of those speaking to, you know, direct themselves to the need to be efficient with time. Secondly, also, I will remind that where written statements have been pre-circulated, they can be taken as read, and so the initial contributions made by witnesses essentially only need to be running to the core conclusions, and then we can move quite rapidly thereon. So, Mr. Linus, I'm going to return to you.
Yes.
Roughly how long do you think you need?
Well, sir, Scott Lannister, the applicant, we've been reflecting on progress as well over lunchtime, and I think I was going to suggest that I only have one or two extra questions for Ms. Spain. It's going to be, we think, more beneficial to you for you to hear our response from the experts involved in those topics. And I was going to suggest that rather than hear the evidence of each of the parties and then have everything gathered at the end, it may be more helpful, certainly to us, if we hear the, we've heard the PLA and the ESL evidence. If I can then ask my witnesses to deal with that, then move on to the next party. We can deal with, can deal with that.
I guess I have a slight concern about that, and that simply is then that there may well be some compounding factors which end up getting multiply dealt with, or alternatively, you know, if having heard our way through this material, it's then clear that certain things are at the top of the mountain and other things are of relatively less importance, then that enables you to direct yourself and your witnesses much more clearly. I was just a little bit concerned about essentially a session following each of these when in fact they can be picked up in the round at the end.
We can try, sir, Scott Lannis for the applicant. We can try it. The only thing that occurred to us is that certainly we would have heard a lot of evidence by then, and it's simply a case of organising several different parties at once so we could be most effective. But we can certainly try to do that.
One of the things that I will be trying to do is to be careful about when a break is called, and I would recognise that you have an organisational task to complete, and we'll try and time the break to enable that work also to be done and some conversations to be had.
Very well, thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Anybody else want to raise anything about timing, or shall we just push on? Mr. Linus, you can return to Ms. Spain.
Final couple of questions. Scott Linus for the applicant, Ms. Spain. Just to confirm that, I mean, you have been involved in hazard risk scoring in other NRAs prepared by the PLA and others, that's right, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yes, and indeed you were involved in the scoring for the North East Spit NRA, that's right, isn't it?
That's correct.
So you must be familiar with the principles in play, that's right?
Yep.
Yes, and we note from your statement that although you've said today that there was, you're under time pressure, you did note that there was substantial discussion on the four areas of hazard identification that had been agreed at the outset of the meeting. That's right, isn't it?
Can you just clarify
that? You said in your statement that there was substantial discussion on the four hazards that had been identified at the outset of the meeting. That's right, isn't it?
Well, there was discussion on the day.
Yes. And part of that, to try and keep the discussion efficient, was it was agreed, wasn't it, that there wasn't any issue being raised with the risk controls that had been included by way of additional risk controls in the NRA, was there? There was no issue raised about the effectiveness or the applicability of those risk controls, was there?
No, there was little discussion regarding risk control?
No. So essentially, for the purposes of understanding where any residual scoring might lie, there's no dispute by the PLA that the risk controls included in the NRA by the applicant should be taken into account. That's right, isn't it?
I'm sorry, can you...
Yes. There's no dispute from the PLA that the additional risk controls that were taken into account in the NRA should be taken into account as part of any residual risk scoring.
Yeah, can I just pass that over to...
Well, I would quite like an answer from you on that, as far as the PLA is concerned.
Yeah, I wasn't quite understanding the point of the...
There was a list of risk controls included in the NRA, which went beyond the embedded controls that were going to be taken into account in the inherent risk scores. There was a list of additional risk controls that then led to the residual scoring in the NRA. You understand that, yes?
Is this the original NRA?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And one of the things that was identified at the beginning of this meeting was that there was no issue being taken with the effectiveness of those additional risk controls as measures which should be taken into account in reducing risk. We don't understand you to be raising any issue with that. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not aware of...
No, okay. And in the addendum NRA, it identified that the Northeast Spit NRA had identified a range of risk controls itself. That's right, isn't it?
Correct.
And there was a list set out in the addendum NRA. I wonder if we could have that up, please, Sammy. Page 48 on the written page, table 13. And one thing we just like clarified, insofar as that NRA identified a range of recommended measures, have they all been implemented as recommended?
Yeah, I can't actually read that from here, so I'd have to get back to you on that one.
Is it possible to actually zoom in to enable it to be...
Yeah, that's correct.
So they have all been implemented, is that correct? Can you say that here?
No, they've not all been implemented.
Right. Which have not been implemented? Have any of them been implemented?
Yes, they have.
Can you identify which ones, please, so we can understand?
Yeah, I would have to just clarify that all of them in the format that they're written in have been, which ones have and which ones haven't. So I'd have to get back to you on that.
Right. If we can then deal with that as an action at deadline 5.
Thank you very much. And you'll see there's a list of other matters which were not adopted, presumably Ms. Spain, on the basis that it was considered that it was unnecessary to do so given the North East Spit operations.
And that's correct.
Right. And again, are any of these under consideration by the PLA in relation to this case or otherwise at the moment?
I think Ms. Payne has already made it clear that she does not know the answers to that today, but that we are going to get back to you at the next
Can I just make sure that the status of the other controls that have been identified as not being adopted, just understand what the status of those is as well, please?
At deadline 5, if that's possible. Yes, please, if that can be added as an action.
Thank you very much. So those are my questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, now, moving on. London Pilots Council. What I think would really assist here is if we can have your document onto the screens. Now, as I indicated, that you can take that as read by us and indeed by all others, I trust. So what hopefully we can do is a very brief summary position by yourself that essentially sets out what you take us to the highlights, what are your overarching and most important conclusions, and then I will make you available for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Andrew Syme for the London Pilot Council. If I may just take you back to classification of vessels. Class 4, 120 metres by 6 metres in draft. Class 3, 145 metres by 7.5 metres in draft. 2, Class 2, 175 by 9 metres in draft, and Class 1 goes up to 320 metres and 13.5 metres of draft. So if I can just go back to number 5 and we discuss the inshore route. The inshore route is fairly self-selecting. We discussed earlier on in the hearing about the depths available to us at the elbow buoy. Now, the London Pilot Council, as such, do not have a problem with 2 miles of room from the elbow buoy to the red line boundary on to the southeast of the elbow buoy, because we see it as a through passage. The majority of vessels using that are Class 3 and Class 4. And the reason why it's Class 3 and Class 4 is that although the elbow buoy sits on 12-metre contours, then to the east of that, we have a 15-metre contour, of which most of the work is carried out in by ESL. However, that doesn't mean that throughout that area we have between 12 and 15 metres of water. In fact, we have to the northeast of the elbow buoy, just a little bit to the northeast of elbow buoy, an 11-metre patch. So therefore, the ruling depth to the southeast of the elbow buoy is 11 metres for all intents and purposes. And so, therefore, it's pretty self-selecting. Class 3 and Class 4, which we can say are smaller vessels, will transit up through the inshore route from the up to the elbow buoy. And in a lot of cases, especially the PEC holders, the dredgers, and also the Class 4 vessels, the smaller vessels, which are going up to the Warps pilot station, then they will just take one course and it goes up through past the elbow buoy and over the northeast spit bank to the west of the northeast spit Raycon buoy. So essentially we don't have a problem with that area, and that's a compromise to the applicant insofar as we agree with the red line boundary in that area.
Can I just clarify, when you say you agree with the red line boundary here, taking account of the proposed structures exclusion though?
Yes, that's correct, sir. Yep. So basically, to the southeast of that area, we're working with 1.5 miles of sea room and half a mile exclusion.
I just wanted to be clear, because strictly the red line boundary is at the outer edge of the SEZ.
Now, sir, it's not to say that we don't get larger vessels through there, because we get very regularly the sort of the small feeder vessels, which are 9 metres draft, because with their underkeel clearance, they can quite comfortably navigate across the 11-metre patches and the 13-metre passages that exist within that 12 to 15-metre contour. In addition to that, we look at small tankers, and we have to look at the safety management systems that exist on tankers, especially gas tankers and specified vessels. And they would probably require a greater underkeel clearance as part of the safety management system. And so it's almost, again, self-selecting. We get Class 3, Class 4 vessels across there, and probably non-hazardous vessels. So that's the chemical tankers, specific oil tankers, and gas tankers. So the inshore route is, as we said, is fairly self-selecting. The other thing is that there's a lot of vessels as you go up through the size. If you look at the Class 2 vessels, which are able to pass through the inshore route because of the draft, wouldn't do so because the visual effect of the wind farm, especially in adverse weather conditions, is a sort of a judgment by the master to say, I don't want to take my vessel up that alleyway, wind farm on one side, a packed anchorage if it's a southwest westerlies to the Margate Roads anchorage. I really don't want to take my vessel up there, and they will come round the wind farm and then come down to the pilot diamond from the northeast. So there's a large amount of judgment from the master, regardless of vessel size, regardless of draft, of which route you'll take down to the pilot diamond. You'll also see that when you board a vessel, that all vessels now will be running some sort of electronic chart system or an ECDIS, electronic chart display and information system. And they will have a safety contour set on the electronic chart systems relative to the available depth of water. So we have hazardous vessels, vessels constrained by their draft, the visual effect of the wind farm, and that all determines whether the larger vessels are going to take that inshore route. Having said that, what it does then is put more pressure onto the northeast spit area, to the northeast of the area. And before I go on to that,
just for clarification, you mean the northeast spit raycon?
The northeast, an area specifically. If I can take you back a couple of hearings ago, and I was pretty determined that everybody was going to accept that we have a choke point to the to the southeast of the northeast spit raycon buoy. That's our main congested area because you had ships coming in, ships going out, and we were talking at the time about sea room at the diamond because that's where we're doing our pilot operations. But of equal consideration and concern really to the pilots is this area where the manoeuvring is taking place, also on the diamond, but that little area to the northeast of the diamond, southeast of the northeast bit, Raycon Buoy. And I just want to say that before I go on to that actual area at the northeast spit, then if you look at the deep water diamond as it exists at the moment, we discussed it in great detail at one of the workshops. The main users at the moment of the deep water diamond are the gas tankers. And the gas tankers for the Medway, large vessels, deep draft vessels, and they, because again of their safety management systems, the extra consideration to safety that they have for underkeel clearance, they won't dip down to the northeast spit boarding diamond. And so they tend to board and land the pilots at the deep water diamond. Now, if you look at the proposed red line boundary, then our deep water diamond to the north of the North Thanet buoy, that's only four cables off the red line boundary. So it's absolutely no use to man nor beast as it exists at the moment. Any proposition to move that diamond to half a mile or a mile up into the traffic is a suicide in itself, because that east-west traffic lane to the north of the existing wind farm, never mind the red line boundary, is the busiest traffic route, has the most traffic passing in and out of it. And so to actually move vessels further up into the north is not going to happen, because we've now lost three miles of sea room. We've come down to 1.7 miles, about 43% reduction in sea room in that area. So you've compressed the traffic, and any pilot operations now to the north of the proposed wind farm is a very, very dangerous operation, because basically you're playing in the traffic. It's a motorway across the top there. So what that has done now, it's forced traffic down to the north. What it will do is force traffic from the north, which may or may not take the pilots at the deep water diamond. It seems to be a sort of fashionable thing. There's a lot of ships use it one month, and then next month we never see a ship go there. But it forces traffic all down to the northeast bit boarding diamond. But in particular, that choke point that we discussed, that becomes extremely, extremely busy. And so our choke point, which is a choke point at the minute, has now got even more traffic because of the sea lane that we've created, if I can use the word sea lane, or the through traffic down from the elbow buoy. So you've got to get more traffic which will self-select and go through into the northeast bit area there. You've got traffic which would normally use the deep water diamond. It's disappeared. You can't put a deep water diamond up there anymore. That's got to come down there. And one thing that we haven't mentioned is the growth of the business at the moment. And just last month, I think we did 903 pilot acts. That's well up on this time last year. And our chief executive tells us that our business for March has increased by 11%. And I was going to quote you the numbers, but it's about 0.6 of a million up on the budgeted figure, and our overall tonnage is up a million tons. So, you know, we've got a huge increase in business. Not just in the future, this is happening now. And to pick up a point that the Port of London were making earlier, is that we're always looking out the back window with these figures, with the risk assessments and stuff like that. And there's not enough emphasis given to the Port of London growth. And that growth gives you bigger ships and more ships. And where we get these ships from, it's not just me saying we're going to get bigger ships, but the London Gateway's got three berths coming online, Gateway 4, 5 and 6. And with those 4, 5 and 6 coming online, we'll almost certainly then dredge the North Edinburgh Channel to get bigger ships down to the northeast spit because of the huge pressure this puts on the pilot boat up at the Sunk, which is struggling, believe me, because I'm up there every day, struggling at the moment. The other thing is that we've just about to bring online a brand new tanker berth at Oikos 2, which is for Aframax tankers. So inbound will come in via the Sunk because of their draft, outbound will come out through the northeast spit. After the Gateway, we've got Oikos 2. We've just got two berth upgrades, one at Gray's New Star Terminal, where they've upgraded the tanker berths to bring in larger tankers, 200 metres by 11.3 draft, which will come out via the northeast spit, and similarly at Vopak. So the growth is there now, never mind what's happening tomorrow. So that really is a sort of an overall view of my choke point, if we can go back a few hearings, of how busy that is going to become. A lot has been said about the sea room of 2 miles. I find it quite frustrating that you can have 2 miles, but you've got to have your back to the Raycon buoy, or you've got to have your back to the red line boundary. And real life doesn't happen like that. Ships come in every day. You either get mist, fog, heavy weather, traffic, and the master wants to have his ship in the middle, where he's got more room around him than anything else. And especially when he looks out the window and he sees a wind farm, I think you saw in my submission, just the sheer size of the London Array, which are the similar turbines that will go in at the Thanet. It's quite a daunting thing when you have a ship quite close up to them, because the master knows he doesn't have enough sea room rather, to turn his ship out in the event of anti-collision. So we've got a very, very difficult situation there at the northeast bit, potentially. We started off the conversation looking at radar pictures, and I don't need to go through all of those again, but the closer you get to radar, then your ability to organise yourself for anti-collision purposes is very, very restricted, and the danger increases I think tenfold. It brings me a little bit onto the risk assessment workshop, and I must confess I'm a simple sailor, so although I followed the process, I'm new to that sort of risk assessment, and I felt a bit of disconnect really with the process, because I think I said in my submission I thought we were plucking numbers out of the air. The one of the gentlemen from across there was saying, well, you had three miles, and now you've got 2 miles. Let's increase the risk by 30%. And I was like, no, that really doesn't fit with me, because you're putting large ships in closer proximity with you. You're increasing the danger a lot more than sort of 30%. Plus, we're putting, by everything I've just said, putting more ships into that sort of choke point area. So I couldn't quite sort of engage with that sort of number pulling guesstimation. And on top of that, I really didn't agree with sort of 10% growth, because I think we will be looking far in excess of that for the Port of London business in the future. I'd just like to say something about the simulator with the bridge simulating report. I use the simulator. All pilots have to go in there, and we do training on different berths. It's an 18-year-old simulator. It last had an update in 2012 when it went from Linux to Windows system. They couldn't produce a wind farm. They had to put oil rigs on it. So it wasn't representative at all what we would see down the northeast spit with these huge turbines going in. There wasn't a pilot boat. They had to use a tug. And I think it's very difficult to say, well, we use multiple vessels situations with anti-collision, when it was only possible for one of the vessels to use a radar. So I don't know how we square that on the bridge simulator report. And I would suggest that to get decent information to support any case the applicant had using a bridge simulator report, they would have to use a better simulator than the one we have, because it's purely designed and operated for pilots training to look at, for instance, pivot point when you're using tugs, and different tide effects on berths when we're berthing vessels.
May I just ask a clarifying question before we pass to Mr. Lias? Figure 5 in your presentation, could we scroll to that, Sammy? I think I understand it, but I think it would be useful for you to just talk us through it. Are we seeing here an example of an outbound vessel that is going to be dipping down to land a pilot?
Yeah, well, these are reciprocal courses, sir. So you would have an inbound vessel and an outbound vessel. The point is that if you were an inbound vessel from the northeast, would you be able to see the traffic on the other side of that wind farm? And the particular picture shows the AIS signature of a vessel down there. Now, a lot of vessels don't have AIS, small fishing boat, especially leisure craft. And also, you wouldn't pick the pilot boat AIS signature up until you're a lot closer to it. So you have a distinct shadow or blind sector, knowing what's behind that wind farm, and you're asking a master of a large vessel to keep his speed on and turn really down into what is a blind alley until he is physically in the turn.
Thank
and
you.
As having been master of large vessels, you wouldn't do it.
I suppose I might just clarify the point at which course is there plan to change just to the north of the existing array.
Yes.
Is what the, if you like, the ideal passage plan would have current status quo.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Lyness.
Scott Lyness for the applicant. Again, as with the other witnesses, I'm going to deal with this evidence, the technical nature of it, with my own witnesses later. I just want to ask a couple of questions of clarification, if I may, in relation to figure 8 in your representations, please.
Right.
Pick that up. Now, I think this is intended to indicate, as we understand it, what you would regard as an acceptable area of sea room. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Basically, you have to the from the northeast Goodwin up to the northeast Spit Bank. You have really this area which is going to be predominantly used by Class 3 and Class 4 vessels, and just as a refresh, that's for vessels with drafts of less than 7.5 metres. The chart datum on the northeast spit bank is 8.6.
So I think just trying to establish where we are so we can ask my witnesses to comment on it. But I think you've accepted, as far as Elbow is concerned, 2 miles would be acceptable, and we provide that, so there's no issue in that area of the scheme. That's fair, isn't it?
It's a transit area. The area does come under pressure when there's heavy weather, especially with northeasterly winds, because the pilot boat struggles to get as far up as the Diamond in any reasonable amount of time, and then in some cases safely. The traffic may be served south or east or slightly to the northeast of the Elbow Buoy.
Yes, but there's no the fundamental point, there's no issue between us on that area of the scheme. No,
you can move on, Scott.
Right. And again, just trying to understand it, where you have shown the 2.7 mile distance, that's at the junction of the Anchorage line and the North Sector 4 line,
yes.
We understand that's right. Now, I mean, if you look at where what we have done in that location, in our addendum NRA, any plan within the addendum NRA which shows the distances, we can take up, please, figure 1 within the addendum NRA. Sorry, it'd be figure 1 in the Appendix 14 document. Let me find the reference within the SEZ plan. You've got it, yes, thank you. When we look at what you have, where you have asked for 2.75, we have provided, as we see it, 3.4 miles at that junction. Is that fair?
I'm just trying to find my chart on that. Yeah, if you've got a measurement from that intersection to the corner of the red line boundary.
Yes, so we meet what you were looking for in that location as well, don't we?
I think there's a clarification just to make there.
Yes.
It's your 3.4 figure that just quoted is actually to the PECT line is the inner line of the of the SEZ, the Structures Exclusion Zone.
Yes.
The red line boundary being, in this case, not figured from
Correct.
That particular point.
Correct. But I think the point is, Scott Lyons, for the applicant, the point is that we have indicated an area there of 3.4 nautical miles, which, when we looked at your plan, seemed to compare with the 2.75 that you said you needed in that location.
Mm.
Now, I just want to understand. I mean, that's a fair comparison, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so actually, the extent of agreement between us on what you are proposing goes further than Elbow, but goes further to the north, to the location of the northeast spit pilot diamond, does it?
To say that again?
Yes, sorry? I'm just trying to understand where we have shown 3.4 at that intersection point. That can be equated to your 2.75 in your figure 8, which suggests that we're providing what you're seeking in that location as well.
Yeah, from the northeast bit pilot boarding diamond, we had a previous sea room of 3.1, as I look at it, to the red line boundary of the existing wind farm. Do you agree with that?
Well, I'm just looking at the plan that you've drawn.
Yeah.
Mr. Symes, I'm trying to understand what actually is the extent of disagreement between us, because I think you've accepted that our 3.4 equates to the 2.75, which is essentially...
Yeah.
Could I suggest, is it possible that we shrink that image down and put them two side by side? Ah, they're both opening in Adobe.
Yeah.
Okay.
Might be can I suggest that? I'm not entirely sure on what I'm looking at the minute. Can I suggest that we have a look at that? Save a little bit of time here.
Well, I just want to, well, I do want to try and understand exactly what the area of disagreement is, if I can. If you can't answer the question, obviously, well, say so, but...
Well, I brought an electronic chart with me so that if we have an issue with any area, we can perhaps have a look at it by using a VRM on an electronic chart.
Business. Good.
And then that saves a little bit of time, and maybe we can do that over the break and then come back to that one.
Are you content with that, Mr.
Martin? I mean,
I think
yes.
I'd be far happier if there was a kind of common base. I mean, the technology seems to be struggling with placing the two charts side by side at the moment. We're in danger of making fools of ourselves.
Yeah. I hope you can understand why I asked the question, sir. Trying to cut this short. And just for clarity, before we move on, the 3 mile distance that you have set out on that plan, again, when you look at that in the context of our SEZ plan, can we get our SEZ plan up again, please? I think the point out, if I can register the point that I'm going to put, that when you apply that 3 nautical mile distance to the plan that is in the SEZ plan, that distance too is provided. So, but can you?
Given me 3 nautical miles to the SEZ.
On the location that's measured on your plan, I think we think we have. On the location that's on your plan.
I think that where the cursor is at the moment. Sammy, you've got it placed exactly right. If can you just move it slightly? So at that particular point, we have a dimension from the intersection of Northfall and Sector Light and the anchorage limit to the PECT line, which is in excess of the dimension that is within your preference,
right,
as submitted in the Deadline 4C.
Yes.
What I think would really assist as well, I mean, I would strongly encourage the conversation in the break on a shared chart base.
Yeah.
What would really assist here is if then at deadline 5, an overlaid composite document could be produced on an agreed common chart base with essentially Mr. Syme's position and your position at the same scale overlaid, because that would... deal with the matter.
Yeah. And I think really what we want to move on to is that the point that is really in contention, Ms. Linus, it seems to me, is moving round the clock face is the separation from the northeast bit, Raycon.
Yes.
Mm. Correct. Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think we had sought to overlay that ourselves to work out what the position was, and either we can put that up on screen if we have it, or we can deal with it outside the examination, whichever would assist the panel.
I think this is a post-hearing submission.
Yes.
Okay, very well.
I mean, some of the charts that I have produced, I've had the luxury of being able to sit down and do them on a proper chart mapping computer system. And because of the pressure of time, I didn't have that. And so
we are very conscious of that.
Just one
very brief little technical fix that might help us here. If you actually open multiple browsers, have you got Chrome?
No, I don't have Chrome, but I can open multiple browsers. Okay. Apologies, I was trying to use 2 different PDF softwares to enable them to go side by side, but I can certainly open it.
Because if you had 2 separate browsers, I think you might crack it.
Okay.
Well, I think if you would allow us to...
Yeah, no,
to
I think
get together
sensibly, I think...
Put it on an electronic chart and then make a printout of the 2 propositions.
Okay. In the light of that, sir, I'm going to ask my witnesses to deal with the point about the Northeast Raycon buoy and other associated issues relating to the radar and so on. I'm content to leave it there.
Okay, thank you very much. In which case, Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Now, moving round, Captain Harris.
Trevor Harris for Trinity House. Trinity House's position substantially hasn't changed throughout the whole hearings, and that our basis for our concerns are all on the qualitative side, or mainly on the qualitative side. We do welcome the introduction of the SEZ, and from seeing the SEZ, it is undeniable there has been an increase in seaweed to the west of the wind farm in that. And from the points through section 5 of the agenda on point A, the definition of adequate safe seaweed, again, that's another hard one to define qualitatively. We can't deny that the 2.1 miles that is offered is unsafe in that. In the majority or most weathers, sea states, probably, yes, it most probably is safe. Although we have heard from other colleagues here that in certain weather, they do not consider it safe. The area around the northeast Spit Cardinal, the increase in seaweed is noted. Our concerns on the constriction of traffic within these areas are slightly alleviated because of the increase in seaweed. We still do have concerns because the unknown aspect of other vessels operating in the area, as my colleague Captain Barker has pointed out at all previous hearings and within some of our other written submissions, we do not know, we cannot quantify what these other vessels are going to do. The whole risk assessment process has gone down the quantification route and not totally accepted qualitative information put in from other stakeholders initially. The on section B, annex 5 or agenda 5, the adequate safe seaweed for operations of the pilot vessels, Trinity House are of the opinion that any constriction of seaweed will have an effect. We cannot state how much of an effect. That's why we have the pilots and ESL, and we defer to their knowledge on that, and that is how when we base our assumptions and our assessments of marine traffic in the area, we listen to these people. The items within Agenda 5, which deal with the commercial aspect, Trinity House will not have a comment on them and do not have a comment. Moving into the NRA and the workshops that have been held recently, right from the start, our opinion was, even with the initial NRA, as in our original written submissions and at the very start, we accepted the outcomes. We did not accept the interpretation of the results. We acknowledged the results. We found the results intolerable to us and unacceptable to us, whereas the same results the applicant had stated were a LARP and that. Moving in from the last workshops within the NRA, we attended both the workshops in February and then the one in March. And from attending them workshops and the second one where we only got through 4 items, there we were of the opinion that it is a very subjective, it's a very tricky area to work on, and to quantify people's qualitative experiences, again, is extremely difficult, and to come up with an exact figure is not so much an agreement, but more a consensus at the time for everybody. And from working on that, we did only, as has been acknowledged by everybody, we only got through four items. If we'd identified every hazard, we'd still be sat there now and most probably this Christmas trying to go through these and quantify them, which is unrealistic. The results and the outputs, we didn't get round to doing that, which I accept would have been impossible, because if you do an individual hazard and work it through to its conclusion, the results of that conclusion normally do accept your inputs to the next hazard in that, and it is not what is required to be achieved at that stage. And so really you need to come out with the results at the time. We've assessed the output. We haven't commented back on it because our concerns are still purely around the qualitative side and how that has been accepted or not accepted, wholly accepted by the applicant. That's how it appears to us. And from the data available, and one of the questions that Mr. Bradley had earlier was about the designation of the wets from the buoy. Is it exactly from the buoy to the red line and distances there what would come in? Again, that is another subjective comment. My experience is, my most recent experiences of ferries, I was quite happily sort of miss a buoy by a few metres, whereas some of the people that Andy, Mr. Jackson deal with, they won't go within cables of buoys, and that it is another total subjective thing. And so we do accept from the applicant have to make a decision, and it is from point A to point B. We accept their decisions there on that one. And that is really where we come from, really. I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Linus, anything you wish to...
Scott Linus, for the applicant. Just one question related to confirm that as far as you're concerned, your view on safety in particular is predicated on deferring to the judgment of the more local operators, as you've put it.
We have our own assessment tools. We do use our own traffic analysis. We do use IALA traffic analysis tools, but we also then do place a lot of input from local users as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. In which case, noting that MCA do not wish to become directly involved in this item, is that correct?
Nick Salter, MCA. There are a couple of points which I could raise. Mm. Yes.
I think probably the best. Remembering that these are points that are being made and cross-examined, I re-emphasise that when we reach the end of this move around the table, we will return back to a much more normal agenda approach, and we will ask if there are any residual comments around the balance of the agenda items in 5 and 6. If you want to be formally engaged with Mr. Linus's questioning, then by all means speak now, but we could deal with it then. It's entirely up to you. I note we don't have a formal statement from you, and you didn't request to speak earlier.
There's 3 points that I have, and I'm happy to say them now.
If you're happy to say them now, do so.
Thank you. It's a comment on the NRA process that we agree that it's being followed, and it is the information that's being fed into the assessment and the result that's under disagreement. We don't believe that the fact that the process has been followed is enough for it to be accepted and for the result to be agreed. To reiterate Trinity House's comments that the disagreement is based on qualitative assessment, and that needs to be taken into account in addition to the quantitative assessment. There's no required risk assessment methodology. There is guidance, but there is no requirement to say that the hazard identification is the correct one. It's the recommended one. It's the most common one within the industry. MCA has attended hazard workshops in the past, and just wanted to point out that these have taken place before the NRA has been drafted, and generally before a planning application has been made. The advantages of that is that it allows time to resolve issues and to get agreement with the IPs. Just finally, while the risk mitigation may have been assessed as tolerable with mitigation, those risk controls and mitigation remain unagreed. I think everyone accepts that. But just to pick up on something that I mentioned yesterday, it seems that for the purposes of reducing risk to a LARP, that the applicant should consider increasing the sea room area in the northwest. Thank you.
Bear with me a second. I'm just finishing a note. It would assist us if you could make a written submission drawing out those points at the next deadline,
Yes,
five.
Yes, happy to do that.
Possible. Mr. Linus.
Scott Linus for the applicant. Just a couple of questions. Again, we're in the position where, as we understand it, the MCA is expressing its concerns based on its perceived understanding of concerns being expressed by other more local operators. That's right, isn't it?
That's right. When there's local issues involved, yes, we have responsibility to listen to the local navigation.
Yes, so it's not as a result of any independent detailed analysis by yourselves. You're largely relying upon concerns that are based upon concerns being expressed by others.
That's right,
isn't it? Okay, that's the first point. Second point about this, the workshop. I mean, I can ask others to comment on this in due course, but it's right, isn't it, that the MCA was offered a workshop prior to the application for consent being submitted?
I believe we were offered a meeting. It's a tricky one for me to answer. I wasn't actually employed by the MCA at that point. But I believe there was a meeting held with the MCA and the applicant.
Yes. Yes, our understanding is that a workshop was offered to go through all the scores in the NRA, but that offer was not taken up. Can you confirm
a workshop
that?
Between who?
The applicant and the MCA.
So just the MCA and the applicant?
Well, yes, at that stage, but...
Right.
If it helps, the XA has noted that point.
Yes, thank you very much.
There's a submission, I rather suspect, at deadline one, which covers this regard to a comment on minutes of a meeting.
Thank you. We
have got that blocked.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Those are my questions.
Thank you. In which case, Mr. Owen.
Thank you, sir. Robbie Owen, Port of Tilbury and DP World London Gateway.
And briefly, just before you start, if we could also now have the relevant report on the screen as well.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Sir, as I said earlier, our main witness is Mr. Vince Crockett. I am going to ask Mr. Hutchinson just to deal with one issue at the end, if that's okay as well, but it won't take very long.
Indeed.
So I'll take Mr. Crockett through a number of issues and ask him in relation to each to say what he wishes to say to the examination. First of all, Mr. Crockett, would you introduce yourself in terms of your qualifications, position and experience?
Vincent Crockett, Technical Director in the Ships Group in HR Wallingford. And my day job really is specialising in management of navigation studies, and primarily these are navigation simulation studies, and particularly real-time simulation studies.
Thank you. And could you tell the panel what your involvement has been to date in relation to this application and the advice that you've been giving to Tilbury and London Gateway?
currently, to date, been preparing for ISH 5 workshops, hearings, and primarily then as part of that process, developing a report, which will be on the screen somewhere. Indeed. Like that.
And that, so, yes, and that's a report that was submitted at deadline 4C, and if we could actually please go to the appendix to that, and which is, have you got that, the appendix to that, please? Thank you. Yes, if we can go to the front of the report, then Mr. Crockett, back to you in terms of, I think you've got some contextual points now you want to make, which the report deals with.
Okay. If we could just bring up probably the front cover of the report, it's probably good enough for now. I would say as well that it has been authorised, it's just our system that the watermark is only removed by our project support group, so it has actually been authorised. Mm. It's a nuisance, but that's our system. Just on the front cover here, we've tried to encapsulate the context of the different ways of getting in to the Port of London and indeed the Port of Medway. We've heard already great detail of this area, and everybody's done a much better job than I'm ever going to do, but it is of use to just say that the route is used by a wide range of ships, including ballast LNG carriers, cruise ships. I know they go into the Port of London category as passenger ferry, but actually it's important to remember they are actually cruise ships, often with several thousand people on board, and they could be much bigger in the future. Fishing vessels, various types there. So a wide variety of ships coming through that area. And as Captain Barker has noted in the past, you could call it what you like. It's an inshore route. Perhaps it's a general navigation area, but I think it's more helpful in this context to probably just call it an inshore route. And because it is definitely a route that is used by reasonably dense shipping, approximately about just under 11,000 movements a year. There is evidence here that people are using, as exactly as Captain Syme said, is self-selecting. And there does appear evidence from the work that we've done that people are using it, perceiving it as time-saving benefits. In other words, very often container feeder ships will go to destinations in the Mediterranean and to the south. So it is quite an important route, and we've also made an effort to show the value of cargo that comes through that route. In terms of the principal points we'd like to make, there's the baseline inputs of the traffic to the NRA process in general, and where it's, again, it's this point really of looking through the rearview mirror, rear window, whatever you want to call it. Yes, the percentage of ships that are around about the Capstan class now of 333 is small, but it's actually a very, very important element there, and it's the future that's important.
Mr. Crockett, can I just intervene? And I think you're now turning, aren't you, to the issues that were summarised in our deadline 4C submissions, and the first of those is the issue we had under the heading of shipping traffic mix, which is one of the inputs to the risk assessment process.
Yes, yes. I'm jumping back and forth a little bit here, but I'm trying to capture, moving on then to the inputs here are that you've got baseline traffic at the moment, growth that is based on that baseline, if you like, but also the terminals that are coming around. And we believe that we've demonstrated. Could I go to section 4 of the report, please? That's what we wanted to get to. We're hopping around a bit here. And figure 4.1, I believe. Yes. So in this figure, we have shown quite rapid growth in. These are Department of Transport statistics, so they are public domain statistics. We have shown quite rapid growth, almost 90% growth in container ship calls into the Port of London, which I haven't checked, but it possibly makes it the largest container port in the United Kingdom by container ship calls. So it's there. So that's quite at odds with a statement in the NRA that we could use 10% growth, and also that the ports like Tilbury and Gateway are minority contributors to the actual growth of traffic and vessel movements in and out of the Thames estuary. It's actually almost closer to 50%. So that statement is not quite accurate there. Moving on to the pilotage simulation study, we have actually discussed this at length, and I think our principal concerns here, we heard from Captain Syme about the limitations of the PLA simulator. We understand it is a underlying marine perfectly fine simulation centre. We understand that, and we've done work ourselves on the PLA simulator in the past. The key issue is, I think, is that the ships that were used, it was a perfectly respectable study, but the ships that were used were manifestly not looking at the future. It really was rear mirror view exercise, because the ship that was used was a small Grandi class ship, and bearing in mind the points that Richard Jackson made yesterday, that a small ship can be more awkward, really the sweat path for a large ship is the one that we should be checking. And we should also be checking on at least one more simultaneous operation at the same time. So probably what we're looking at are testing those ships that we discussed in the workshop on the 27th of February. We did go through a range of ships on the 27th of February and looking at some of those. Some of them may not work, incidentally. We recognise that. If they don't work, you've got an evidence base for saying it doesn't work, we'll have to do something else. But to not do it, there is a big gap in the evidence base, we would argue. Just move on.
Before you move on, just in terms of the Marico Marine report that you referred to earlier, Mr. Linus was mentioning that, thought that the quote was taken out of context. Yeah. I wonder if you could just clarify so we're all completely clear what that report was prepared for, what its relevance is now, and perhaps you could just pull up. Could we pull up the report? Actually, it's section 7, I think, from memory, page 14, I think.
I think it was the conclusions.
Yeah, thank you. So Mr. Crockett, is this report part of the current risk assessment that is before the examination?
This report does form part of the current process because we were informed of that yesterday, and it is the only other. There have been two activities to inform the navigation support to the extension. One of them is the risk assessment process, and the other is a navigation simulation. This is the only other piece of evidence that we have to support the risk assessment. And we also understood yesterday that the navigation simulation should inform the risk assessment and not really the other way around. So obviously that's not always possible.
Sorry. And if we can just go further down page 14, please, just a little bit. So what do you make from those two bullet points there?
The one that really I think is important is bearing in mind that what we're looking for here in terms of a navigation simulation, as we said at the previous hearing, the primary purpose for carrying out a navigation simulation is to find if we've got enough space. It is a space assessment tool. It's not a depth assessment tool. That's what it's for. And when you look at that first bullet point at the top of the screen there, the words that really come out are the words critically, significantly changed, and markedly. There's three adjectives there that really do catch the eye, and they've been written carefully. And to say that we don't need another navigation simulation really is at odds with that statement. And further down in the recommendations, if we may just scroll down through the institutional stuff, if you go down a little bit more, there's an Anchorage one. Yeah. Okay. If you go down. There was one also, I'll put myself out of the misery, is that the other one was that the boundary of the Margate Anchorage roads should be relocated, which is another way of saying that the size of the Margate Road Anchorage should be reduced. So that's a spatial. So that was a clear.
There it is.
Yeah. So there's training, there's lots of warm words about training and things like that. It's all we know and recognise. But actually, it went to the nub of the matter and said, even with this simulation, we actually need more space.
Okay. So this is the current document that your view is what in terms of what should happen to it?
Okay. Just in terms of our heading towards where we're trying to get to here, we do not consider that this document can be relied on for making a decision. That's a clear view, and that's why yesterday we said it was essential that it's repeated, not out of any criticism or anything like that, but it clearly is not adequate for the reasons I've stated, and particularly because it does not look at the future. Not well, in fact, it doesn't even look at current technology. It's quite hard to look at future technology, but it doesn't look at the ships that we're handling today, let alone what might be around in the future. Okay.
Mr. Crockett, before we come on finally to the risk assessment process, you dealt earlier with two of those issues in our deadline for sea submissions, shipping traffic mix and demand profile. Just in relation to demand profile, can you tell us what discussions were had in the risk assessment workshops about why only 10% was being factored in for growth in use of this inshore route?
Okay, if we go back a step, in the original NRA in Section 6, there was a number that just basically said it's 10%. And we understand that as to why that would be there. It's often in lots of other risk assessments as well. The number was never really, correct me if I'm wrong, Trevor, when we come to it, but correct me. We never really got onto growth, I don't think, in terms of the Friday the 29th workshop. I think that's a fair statement, that we didn't really get there because it was quite a time-constrained process. So the growth would come in afterwards on that.
And this is growth in vessel traffic. I mean, we've just heard this afternoon about a huge increase in growth of pilot boats. I suppose one follows the other, is that right?
Yeah, well, I think we need to be careful about growth because if a demand profile had been prepared in the original NRA, and we readily understand that often it's a relatively superficial section in an NRA, but I think given the complexity of the Thames estuary and it's got some of the largest ports in the United Kingdom, then that section could have been more comprehensive. And it is better now because it does actually, instead of giving a United Kingdom approach, it actually gives a regional approach. But one would expect that in an NRA, in a proposal like this, that one might have at least considered where RoRo traffic is going, where container traffic's going, where LNG demand is going, etc. So that has not been considered. And we heard from Captain Syme today that he referred to them as gas carriers, but I'm assuming he referred to LNG carriers. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. And finally, for you, before we turn to Mr. Hutchinson, we've heard a lot about the risk assessment process and the workshops and such things that have taken place. I know you had a few thoughts you wanted to share with the hearing on that issue.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. We've already heard today, this afternoon, several people. The actual approach adopted is quite common. It's the IMO formal safety assessment, and as our colleagues from the MC have already said, it's a very standard approach, and there is no prescriptive approach to it. But the way that we have followed it, I think there's two key points to make, is that one, the treatment of costs, that Dr. Rogers quite rightly said that people dodge the cost-benefit analysis for reasons we won't go into today, but costs are treated in a difficult way. Some people take costs out, and some people just put them in, and then they become notional costs. So the way that costs were treated, we found quite difficult to understand whether they were business costs or whether they were material costs. For example, a glancing blow would have quite a notional cost on it of about £10,000. It's clear that, you know, any collision or glancing blow between two large ships is infinitely more than that cost. So that is the one thing there. Then there's the scoring, really, the inputs there. We did say, and our comments have been recorded, that we would like to have seen a more granular approach to actually just group Class 1 and Class 2 ships together is really simplifying. So, for example, in terms of ship types, the consequences of a ro-ro ship receiving a collision, and one can cite the example of the European Gateway off Harwich, a ro-ro ship's transverse stability is far less, and we've seen that with car carriers. You don't need much more than a glancing blow to actually sink the ship. So, and likewise with a tanker, it would be good, and I understand we could still be there now until Christmas, it would have been good to have a more scenario-based approach where container ships, ro-ro carriers, and heaven forbid, even LNG carriers, were separated out so that at least you've got an idea of what is going on there. And then the scoring, finally, is really just where it does become very subjective. And we understand that Ed Rogers, you know, worked through it very efficiently, but he did really rush us on a bit, so we understand that. So those are really the final points I'd make.
And just before I hand over to Mr. Hutchinson, what's your overall feeling or assessment of the process that you were part of in those workshops?
Okay. I think if we had confidence in the navigation simulation, then that might be different. But I think taking that we are not able to rely on the navigation simulation, the only tool we can rely on is the risk assessment process, and we can't rely on that. It's not robust enough. We all sat through that workshop, but taking that together, we're not able to rely on it.
Thank you. Then, if I may just briefly turn to Mr. Hutchinson. Would you introduce yourself, please, and as Mr. Crockett did, just give a quick summary of your qualifications, position and experience, and your involvement to date in this matter?
Yes, Trevor Hutchinson. I'm a planning and transportation consultant representing Port of Tilbury London Limited and London Gateway Port Limited. I've been involved in planning and transportation for around 20 years, 8 of those years as a local authority officer in Thurrock, which is obviously pertinent because that's the location of the two ports, and as a private consultant for 12 years, acting predominantly on behalf of ports and logistics organisations, and in particular involved with London Gateway Port and Logistics Park.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Hutchinson, you were present at the hazard workshop on the 29th of March, I think I'm correct in saying, and yes, attended the hazard teleconference, I think it was called, on the 2nd of April. I understand you've got a few thoughts of your own to just add today in terms of that process and the scoring and the consequences of risks being materialised and how they're scored.
Yeah, I was really just going to try and address this sort of difference of opinion as to the level of agreement and how that might have come about, the level of agreement that was achieved at the workshops. So I was present at both of the workshops, the 27th and the 29th, what I refer to as the hazard workshop. I've adopted that title. And then on the call on the 2nd of April to discuss the wider results of the full 18 subjects. I attended as a layman. I'm not a master mariner. That is not my background. And as such, I was there in part in a watching capacity. What I was looking to see is really the level of comfort that the other parties who do deal with shipping and deal with that on a day-to-day basis. The part where I felt I had a better experience to assess matters is on particularly stakeholders, because the impact on business, because obviously I represent two businesses here, and to a degree on property. Just the word fundamentals was used earlier. We touched upon that, whether we actually sort of set out the basis on which we were carrying out assessment and some of the sort of rules of the road for it. And it was discussed that those did come out. I think there's a chronology point here to understand. I had lots of questions about the sort of rules that we were applying to this assessment. I still sit in here now, have some. Some were dealt with throughout that process, but they were dealt with throughout the day. They weren't dealt with at the start of the day. There were things I was learning at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and people were querying something, and the clarification, I was then taking that clarification on board. But we didn't then go back and reassess the things that we'd looked at prior to that clarification being provided, and I'll talk about a couple of those sort of points. To give a bit of an example of that, the consequence scores were really the ones, the consequence for business and for property were the ones that I was really trying to input into and consider. When we consider the consequence of two Class 1 vessels, for example, well, firstly, we weren't sure what was going to be allowed in the SEZ and not, but people have talked about that, so I won't say any more about that. We were looking at the consequence of an incident, a collision in the first case, in the most likely scenario, which was agreed around the table, would be a glancing blow, and that was a glancing blow involving a Class 1 and Class 2 vessel. There was some confusion as to what it was having a glancing blow with, because there's all kinds of different types of vessels it could hit and all kinds of different consequences of that. The assessment of a glancing blow, if we take it as two Class 1 or Class 2 vessels, I didn't understand what we needed to take into account in that. Does the property, in terms of business impact, if there is a delay to that vessel, is the, now let's say the containers on board have perishable goods and those goods perish because of the delay, is that a property impact or is that a business impact? So there is all kinds of clarifications as to what we were to take account of in a cost assessment or not. Now, the result of the cost assessment of a glancing blow of two Class 1 vessels is that the impact on stakeholders was scored as a one, which is has a value attached to it of under £10,000. And I just find that ludicrous, to be absolutely honest with you, that can be the case, even without the clarifications. There were some issues of, obviously, you've seen the spreadsheets. We were looking at them on a overhead projector. There's an awful lot of numbers on there, and we were focusing on the discussion. I was actually quite surprised when I received the spreadsheets after to see the value of one in that box. I hadn't appreciated that is the number that had fell out of the conversation. It was very difficult to see on the screen. People may remember that I actually changed positions during the meeting because I was sitting in the view of other people. I was sitting between people in that screen, so I moved around the table. Just in terms of then, so basically we went through this process, we reflected. We felt when we saw the scoring that some of the scores just weren't representative. We still had a lot of questions in our own mind as to how we assessed it. We made the applicant aware of that at the call on the 2nd. And when the minutes were provided on the 5th of April, I sent an email to the applicant stating that again. And I note that the fact that we raised those concerns is reflected in the NRA at paragraph 153. So there doesn't appear to be there. I heard statements in closing last night that the scores hadn't been challenged, but the paragraph 153 of the NRA does clearly show that we did subsequently challenge those scores, and we still remain to be to have clarifications to be able to carry out the assessment or understand the assessment.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson, and that's all we wish to say at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll just check if my colleagues have any questions before I hand you to Mr. Linus.
Scott Linus for the applicant. Just deal with Mr. Crockett first, if I may. There was a point raised in your statement that you would like to see a more detailed assessment of risk scores based upon different combinations of vessel types and so on. But I just want to confirm that at paragraph 7 of the main statement, it was confirmed that you were prepared to accept the categorisations of vessels and risks for the purposes of the assessment. That's fair, isn't it?
Yes, that is correct. And in fact, our concerns about the less than granular nature of the ships is actually recorded in the addendum NRA. Yes. We accept that. But yes. It still means that there is a simplification there that on its own is not necessarily... Yes. A major issue, but when you put it together with the other evidence we have to evaluate the extension, it makes life more difficult. But yes,
okay, but taking it in steps, yes, you're prepared to accept that element of the process. Yeah. Thank you very much. Next, future traffic flows, then, please. In the statement at your paragraph 12.1.4, we don't need to get it up, but you say that the 22.5% increase in 2016 to 2018, if we have it up there, yes. Paragraph...
Do you mean the report?
You mean the report.
Your report, sorry, 12.1.4.
Actually, could we go there, please? Yeah. It does assist us.
There we are. The second paragraph down, just want to look at this. The Port of Tilbury had a combined growth of 22.5% between 2016 and 2018. This is greater than the overall 10% growth factor in the NRA. Now, I just want to just examine that. And by doing it, first of all, you accept that a growth in throughput at Port of Tilbury and London Gateway will not of itself translate into the same increase in vessels. That's right, isn't it?
No, that's not correct. And I think just to clarify on that point is that we fully accept that if there's an increase in 400-metre ships, then yes, they will not come that way. Yes. But I think the important thing is that if you're going to get transshipment traffic, and there's numbers of about 700,000 TEU, if that container throughput is transshipped at either more likely at Gateway, then that will generate feeder traffic, and that is precisely the traffic that is vulnerable to the diversion in the inshore route.
Yes, but apart from the fact that an increase in throughput of itself does not mean the same percentage increase in vessels, not all those vessels attributable to that throughput will be going past the wind farm. That's right, isn't it?
That is correct, but yes. As I've just said, that we fully recognise that some of those ships are going to be large ships. If Gateway was simply just going to be handling large ships, then that point would be valid, but it's not valid because if there's also going to be ship-to-ship transshipment, then by its nature those ships are going to be small ships and they are going to be precisely the ships that may well be affected.
Yes, but the point is you can't simply say 22.5% increase in growth at Port of Tilbury and London Gateway necessarily means you're going to be more than 10% more growth past the site.
No, we're not trying to say that there's I think we are not trying to say that there's 22.5% growth past the site, of course not. But it is an indication of the dynamic growth in that one business alone, let alone other business that we've heard about, which is products, tankers, Ro-Ro, and things like that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Again, just picking up a couple of other points that you raised, can we turn to figure 4.1 in your document, please, Mr. Crockett? Yes, you referred to this earlier. Now, you pointed to the increase in London, but if one looks at that figure, obviously there has been a decrease in Medway as well. So one has to take into account not just any increase in London, of which London Gateway and Port of Tilbury only form part, but decreases elsewhere too. That's right, isn't it?
That's correct, and yes. That's precisely why, in anticipation of that question, that we put in the other ones as well.
Yes.
I mean, it's important to say, though, in that of all those four ports, I think one can sort of forget Medway in the sense that it's no longer seen to be a place that large ships can go to. The critical point here is, unlike Felixstowe, Gateway is set up to be a major district park, a Rotterdam district park type port.
Yes, but then if one goes to figure 4.3 later on, a couple of pages later on, it's clear again that when Medway is taken into account, the trend in the blue line is for a decrease in ship arrivals per year. That's right, isn't it?
That's correct,
yes.
And the important point is that table is an aggregate, so during that period, refineries have closed, we've had the Olympics, we've had Crossrail, we've had what that is giving is background to it. We don't dispute that over a 35-year life that there may well be a reduction, it may well be correct. What we're trying to point out in with good evidence is that there is strong growth in relevant sectors at the moment.
Yes, but I mean that was recognised in the NRA, but the fundamental point that was raised in the NRA, which I think you accept, is that any increases that you might rely upon, particularly with the Port of Tilbury and London Gateway, take place in a context of a trend of a decrease in ship arrivals per year. That's the evidence at the moment, isn't it?
That is correct, yes.
Yes, thank you. And again, when one's assessing your proposition about an increase in growth from Port of Tilbury and London Gateway, one must take into account the fact that Port of Tilbury only accounts for a fraction of the traffic going through the inshore route. That's right, isn't it?
I'm not aware that's correct at all.
Right. Well, in your documentation at deadline two, you gave figures for the Port of Tilbury vessels using the inshore route, 534 inbound, you recall?
I'd need to just check that number, yeah.
Okay. Right. And the corresponding figure for London Gateway was 79, do you recall that?
Just having a look now.
Okay. So deadline three. Deadline
what three. I want to check is whether this is just AIS data before more full analysis was done.
No, the document that I'm looking at in your deadline three statement, you referred to PLA Polaris data for the year ending 30th of November 2018.
Could you give us a paragraph reference, please?
Yeah, it's under a wider section, 3.2. There's no pages or other paragraph numbers, I'm afraid. That's it, under that heading. And then, okay, do you have it? And then for the Port of London vessels, inbound, there are a total of 3,127 recorded piloted trips total. I'm sorry, previous paragraph. From the AIS data supplied by the PLA, 534 vessels use the inshore route inbound. Regional estimate, similar vessels use the inshore route outbound. 79 vessels for London Gateway, total of 4,114. Now, I mean, I don't think we'd accept you would necessarily estimate a similar number of vessels using the inshore route outbound as an inshore, but clearly only some of the vessels transiting the inshore route are as Port of London traffic, and it applies to an even stronger degree to London Gateway.
Okay, we should clarify that. Just to be very clear on this, that Polaris data is capturing piloted movements.
Yes.
So a ship of under 90 metres, 89.9, of which there are many, will not feature in the Polaris data.
Do you mean AIS or Polaris?
No, I mean Polaris data.
This is AIS data, sorry, I'm referring to.
Okay.
Okay. So again, it's just a simple proposition that insofar as the NRA has allowed for a 10% increase overall in commercial traffic, including along the inshore route, one must take your allegation about Port of Tilbury in its proper context, because any increases in Port of Tilbury traffic would only be a fraction of the total traffic in the inshore route. That's right, isn't it?
No, I don't think we could accept that. I think we'll have to just check that.
All right, okay. And the same point would arise in respect of London Gateway, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
We will check that.
Is it possible just to scroll down in 3.2? Because I'm conscious here that we're looking not at the second part of the paragraph, which is the northeast spit component.
Yes, this is piloted. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could ask the same questions, but. The point is that you have 754 inbound trips picking up a pilot at North East Spit. Again, we've seen the figures that the PLA have produced about total pilotage operations taking place at North East Spit, well over 5,500, well, around about 6,000. So essentially, the number of pilot trips for Port of Tilbury vessels using North East Spit is a fraction of the total pilotage trips taking place at North East Spit. That's right, isn't it?
It is part of what is taking place there, because clearly ships are coming from Port of Tilbury that are too deep draft to use that route.
Exactly.
We accept that, yeah. They're not all using it.
And And the same applies to London Gateway vessels to an even greater degree. Of the total recorded piloted trips from London Gateway, only 160 took up a pilot at North East Spit. So again, if you compare that figure with the total piloted operations at North East Spit, the number using vessels going to London Gateway is relatively small.
I think the report is very clear that it makes the point that the North East Spit area is far more important for Tilbury than it is for London Gateway. I think that's very clear.
But even accepting that relative point, the proposition is that when examining the robustness of the approach taken in the NRA, one has to recognise that it allows for 10% overall all traffic in a context of an overall trend of decrease. And when one then looks at the Port of Tilbury traffic, one must recognise that it's only a fraction of the growth that would occur on the inshore route.
OK, I think that is essentially where we get to the nub of the matter, is that the 10% in the NRA original document is simply exactly that. It's a global aggregate percentage, which, if it was done properly, would actually apply to those sectors. For example, it would relate to the United Kingdom's energy gas imports, and you'd actually be able to put a percentage. Some sectors inevitably are going to decline as people close captive industries. Other sectors may grow. But just to give a global 10% is not very meaningful. And I think that is really what we were trying to say in our original critique of the NRA, that 10% is not helpful in an estuary context. One needs to know whether it's 15% growth in one sector or 0% in another.
But when looking at the challenge that you have made, again, I'll ask this one question and move on. One must bear in mind that any increases upon which you rely only relate to a fraction of the traffic going through those routes. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, inevitably, we are representing businesses that are the primary areas of growth are probably in construction materials, ro-ro and containers.
Okay, and next, please.
Is that on this same point?
No, I'll be moving on.
You're moving
to a
on.
Separate point.
Well, before we move on to the next point, can we just then make clear that in relation to Mr. Crockett's clarification around the deadline three figures at paragraph 3.2A, we just need to make sure when that's going to happen. Ideally after the break, if that was possible, or would along... Yep. I mean, we'll give at least 20 minutes on the break.
Yes, that should be fine, sir.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Sorry, I know it's gone 3:30. Were you intending to take any break? That would be a convenient moment. Otherwise, I'm happy to press on. I only have another 10 minutes, but I thought I'd mention it anyway.
Yeah, look, my sense was that I would actually like you to complete Owen's witnesses, and then we can actually start with a brief wash-up.
Yes.
And we can then move on to structuring the remainder of the afternoon.
Very well, thank you, sir.
Sir, if I can just add, Robbie Owen, so far I have just one point of re-examination.
Okay, well, that I would be very quick content point. For that to actually come before the break. I think it would be nice to have all of the examination and re-examination completed.
Very well. Next point, please. Section 9.2 of your document, please, Mr. Crockett.
Is this the report?
Your report, yeah. If I say your document, I mean
sorry,
the report.
All right. Understood.
The trouble is there are just too many documents.
Yes, you might be able to tell. Now, after a large amount of contextual information in your report, in 9.2, you say, as may be expected, larger ships operating in routes passing north and west are most likely to be affected by wind farm extension. This is not because there will be insufficient space for the ships to make a safe passage through the area. So again, we've heard submissions made earlier today. We don't understand your case to be about sea room available for the passage of ships. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
But I would emphasise there it is through passage. So, for example, a ship of less than 90 metres would presumably quite happily go through there with no difficulty at all, and probably larger ships.
Thank you very much. Now, the hazard scoring, I dealt with a discrete point at the outset. You have said that there was a point raised, Mr. Hutchinson raised it as well, about consequence scores. I just want to understand that at that hazard workshop, other matters were agreed between the parties, including yourselves. It was the hazards to be considered. The likelihood scores were agreed for the purposes of that assessment as well, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Yes. They were agreed, and we've said that. I think yes. The main concern, and it was noted, is that we reluctantly went along with the non-granular nature of the ships, primarily because of time constraints, and we recognise those time constraints.
Yes, and insofar as any points were raised about the consequence scores, I'll ask Dr. Rogers to deal with those, because we've indicated what a sensitivity analysis would show on that. But there's no dispute, as far as you're concerned, with the hazard scores that would result from the likelihood and consequence scores being fed through the rest of the process to produce the inherent and residual scores, is there?
We didn't have any comments on those, and we've actually stated that, yes. No,
thank you very much. And we've seen as well today that the PLA have produced their own work, whether it's regarded as a separate NRA or a sensitivity analysis. Just so we can understand, do you have any views on the work that's been taken into account by PLA?
Okay, no, we don't have any views.
Thank you very much. Now, the issues with the pilot simulation study that you've raised, again, you raised this point that the study didn't cover vessels of a larger size, but you accept the broad proposition that vessels either travelling through the northeast Spit Raycon buoy or along the inshore route of greater than 240 metres represent less than 1% of the traffic?
No, we wouldn't accept that at all.
What's your figure then?
The reason that we would not accept that is that the 1%, as we said before, is historical data.
Yes, but the data that is in front of the examination, including data which provided by the PLA to yourselves, I think, shows that there are very, very few vessels, larger vessels, particularly above 240 metres, but even more so above 299, travelling along the inshore route or using the northeast or dipping through the northeast Spit Raycon buoy.
Yes, I think really we're missing the point here that navigation simulations are not carried out in the context of the past. They are carried out in the context of the future, and therefore, whether it's a minuscule percent or in the case of 400-metre ships, it's 0%. So we shouldn't do those either. Well, we should be doing the ships that may come in the future.
Dealt with future traffic, but I'm asking a straight question about the evidence that's in front of this examination as of now. As of now, the vessels that are going through the northeast Spit Raycon buoy or through the inshore route above that size is a minuscule percentage of the total traffic.
I'm just going to say, really, that I don't understand the relevance of that question because we're talking about the future.
Insofar as you had any concerns about the future or the future vessel sizes to be taken into account, that is a factor which would be fed into any judgment reached through the navigation risk assessment, isn't it?
That's correct. Yes. So the 333-metre ships that are coming there now presumably need a certain amount of room, and it's not known what room they will have in the future.
Any issue that you may have from your point of view about future traffic going through this route would be fed into scores in the hazard risk assessment. That's right. You accept that, don't you?
That's correct, yes. But that's only part of the picture. Yes. What I'm trying to get across here is that it also needs to be fed into a navigation simulation study.
The end result of any navigation risk assessment is that scoring system, okay?
Provided that navigation risk assessment also incorporates the results of a viable navigation simulation.
Well, insofar as you reach judgments on likelihood scores as part of the risk, perfectly open to you to reach a judgment on likelihood scores based on whatever view you took about future traffic going through these routes, and you had the opportunity to feed that into likelihood scores which were agreed, weren't they?
No, that's not correct, because the broad classification simply says it's a class one or a class two ship, and yes. We have no idea whether that's a 400-metre ship or a 333-metre ship.
But, yes, but you accepted, and that's why I started the question at the outset on this, you accept that you're prepared to accept that classification as suggested by the PLA. And when it came to the hazard risk scoring, you were perfectly entitled to express any view about likelihood of risk based on future movements, based on pilotage operations, and set those out in the hazard workshop. And you agreed likelihood scores there, yes. Didn't you?
The reservations that we have about the risk assessment process are recorded in the NRA addendum.
Can you answer my question, please? You had the opportunity through the workshop to express any concerns you had about the pilot simulation study through discussion on likelihood scores in particular, and you agreed the likelihood scores in that study. That's right, isn't it?
That's not correct. As I am aware, the pilotage simulation study played no part in the 29th of March workshop. No,
but the judgments on scores to be inputted on the four hazards could take into account any views you had about the likelihood of collision or any other factors based on any issues you might have with the pilot simulation study.
I go back to my original point that there is no connection between the pilotage simulation study and the workshop that was carried out on the 29th of March.
Thank you very much. So those are my questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, I did indicate that there would be a brief opportunity for a re-examination. So, Mr. Owen.
So, thank you very much, Robbie Owen. Mr. Crockett, you were taken to figure 4.3 of your report. If we could have that up again, please. What do you observe, please, about the from that table about when the data finishes, when it ends? Sorry, Mr. Crockett. Yeah. What do you observe in terms of what the figure is telling us in terms of when the data is up until?
Yes, I mean, the data at the end has got an uptick because it's reflecting the growth in London Gateway.
But what year do we see there?
And that mirrors really when the London Gateway growth started in 2016. So it's not surprisingly, they're the same statistics. So it's picking up again. So there is no, whatever decline there is in the past, around about 2002, we're now seeing a growth pattern.
So to what extent does this figure, given that it finishes, as we see there, 2017, to what extent does it reflect growth that we've seen recently because of Gateway?
I mean, this graph was put in really to give a context, and it's clearly showing strong growth in the last 3 or 4 years, and that growth is coming through. It's not showing, there has been a decline, we're not trying to pretend there's not a decline, but the last 2 or 3 years there's been strong growth.
Thank you very much. That's all, sir.
Now, Mr. Linus, before we break, did you have any questions for Mr. Hutchinson?
No, I didn't.
None.
I can pick up those points with Dr. Rogers.
Okay. Well, in which case then, ladies and gentlemen, it is now 3:50. I'm going to suggest that we resume at 4:15 and that on resuming, we will have a brief reorientation session and we will structure the rest of the business for the remainder of this particular hearing. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.